Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the very latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org.
This is 1A. I'm Amna Nawaz of the PBS NewsHour, in for Jen White. This is the news roundup. Well, it's been 3 days, and we're already halfway through the Senate impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. The impeachment managers wrapped the prosecution last night, and this afternoon, Trump's attorneys take the floor. Here to give us a sense of how it's all going and to explain some of the strategy behind it all is Anita Kumar. She's the White House correspondent with Politico. Anita, welcome. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
And Julie Pace is also with us. She is Washington Bureau Chief with the Associated Press. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Democratic impeachment managers used extensive audio and video footage of the Capitol riot to make their case against Donald Trump. Their aim was to prove that Trump caused the mob to storm the Capitol building on January 6th.
The evidence will show you that ex-President Trump was no innocent bystander. The evidence will show that he clearly incited the January 6th insurrection. It will show that Donald Trump surrendered his role as commander-in-chief and became the inciter-in-chief of a dangerous insurrection. And this was, as one of our colleagues put it so cogently on January 6th itself, the greatest betrayal of the presidential oath in the history of the United States.
That was lead impeachment manager, Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland. Anita, this is really their main argument, right? So what kind of evidence did Democrats lean on to help make that case, to try to prove that it was Trump who incited the insurrection?
Yeah, well, I think one of the most telling things was that they had statements from some of these protesters, some of these rioters that said they were taking their cue from what President Trump said. So they were watching what he said. They had been listening to him for the previous two months, talking about how the election was rigged and that they were taking their cue from him. They even read some of his tweets out loud to the crowd. So we know that they were paying attention, and I think that was the main emphasis that they were going for. They went into the Capitol and did some things because President Trump told them to do it. But I do think the most chilling thing that they did was show videos that senators had not seen before, showing how close those senators got to the mob. Like the mob was right down the hall or minutes away from them. And I think visibly you could see the senators, that was what impacted them, that they realized how serious this was and how close they got to being attacked.
Representative Ted Lieu of California was also arguing that the attack on the Capitol was basically Trump's final attempt to hold on to the presidency.
What you saw was a man so desperate to cling to power that he tried everything he could to keep it. And when he ran out of nonviolent measures, he turned to the violent mob that attacked your Senate chamber on January 6th. As you cast your vote after this trial, I hope each of you will think of the bravery of all these people who said no to President Trump because they knew that this was not right, that this was not America.
Julie, we just heard Anita lay out sort of the how they make the case that Trump incited the riot through statements and tweets and so on. This was the why part of that argument. How effective was that framing, do you think, that this was a move of desperation to hold on to power?
Well, certainly I think it's effective for Democrats and for probably a handful of Republican senators, but we haven't seen any sign, at least publicly at this point, that it has swayed Republicans who entered this trial inclined to vote to acquit. It doesn't feel like Democrats have moved any of those senators any closer to making that linkage, that this was not just a mob that was inspired by Trump, but that this was Trump's intention to send this mob into the Capitol to disrupt this vote to affirm the election. Whether some of those senators believe that privately, I think is a real question. But whether they vote to actually convict as a result of that Democratic argument, it appears at this point that most of them will not make that argument and will not have been publicly persuaded by the Democrats.
Well, Anita, tell us a little bit more about some of the evidence that they are weighing. You mentioned some of that new video that people had never seen before. You described it as chilling. What exactly did it show? How did you see senators taking it in? How was that resonating with them?
Yeah, one of the most unusual things I think about this trial is there are really no witnesses. The witnesses is the video. So that's what they're showing instead. So we have the impeachment managers talking and showing videos. So they're basically walking through what happened that day. They are showing these video clips with real people. They're seeing Senator Mitt Romney, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence, and showing how they were running, basically running away from the mob and trying to escape. And you can tell how close it is because minutes can go by and then you'll see protesters try to get to that same exact location. So I think that was one of the most effective things they did. But they're also trying to show that this is a pattern or was a pattern for President Trump. They played clips of things that he had said back to 2015. So even before he was president of the United States, showing that this is a pattern. He tries to either applaud violence or push people to be violent. And there was at least one senator who said, I don't know why they're doing this. It told a reporter, I don't know why they're showing this. Why are we going back through all this? But then afterwards, and of course, this was a Democrat saying, OK, now I get that. When you look at it all at once, perhaps there is a pattern. So they're trying to show that he has a pattern. They're also trying to show that there was no remorse because after the riot had started, President Trump continued to tweet. In fact, he continued to tweet about the vice president and how he was upset with him and criticizing him when rioters were in the building and the vice president was trying to escape. So they were trying to show a variety of things about what President Trump has been like and was like these last 2 months before the riots.
Julie, we know, of course, the senators are jurors in this trial, so many of them are reluctant to say anything right now. But have any of them been reacting to that new video that they saw, especially ones that they're featured in?
We certainly have seen some reactions from senators, both their reactions on the floor as they've been sitting there watching this come forward in real time. A lot of them really with rapt attention watching these videos. And certainly we have heard senators talk then to reporters about just how jarring and emotional those videos are. I think one of the unusual features of this trial, you know, an impeachment is different than a criminal trial, a civil trial in the court system in so many ways. But of course, one of the main differences in this moment is that the jurors were very much part of what is unfolding before them in the defense and the prosecution's case. They were the ones who were in the building as it was attacked. And so there's not that sort of natural disconnect that you get between the jurors and effectively the crime that is being prosecuted here. And so I think they can't help but feel emotional and have some pretty visceral responses to it. But again, the other thing that makes a trial in the Senate different than a trial in a court is that it's a political process as much as anything else. And that is very much on the minds, certainly, of the Republicans who are weighing their own personal feelings about what happened with what they believe the right move is politically.
Now, Lee emails, why is this even called a trial? We seem to know the outcome. Most senators have already decided how they will vote. Some of the jury, meaning the senators, are in contact with the defense team. That's not how a trial actually works for the rest of us. I find this disheartening. Clem also writes, calling the jurors so-called impartial jurors, Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, and Mike Lee, meeting behind closed doors with Trump's lawyers. There are some questions here, Anita, about this already being decided, calling this a trial when some Republican senators have already indicated that they are reluctant to convict. Are there any among the Republicans in the Senate that you think could be swayed by the evidence we're seeing?
Yeah, I'll remind everyone that this is exactly what happened a year ago during the first impeachment trial of President Trump, where then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell met with President Trump's legal team, and the same exact argument was made that that the Republicans had already decided. And you could argue that some of the Democrats have already decided, right? They've been, unlike jurors, we actually see them talking, even in the breaks, to some journalists and saying what they think. And we've heard them say, you know, that they're going to wait and decide after they hear all the evidence. We've heard that over and over. But of course, these are politicians, these are senators. So they have been out there talking and on television. You know, I think we have a really good idea of what's going to happen based on the vote that was earlier this week. And that was the first vote on the first day. They talked about whether this trial, this proceeding, is constitutional. Only 6 Republicans said that this proceeding should go forward. So it's very unlikely anyone else, any other Republicans, are going to vote to convict, because they don't even believe that this proceeding is constitutional and shouldn't be going on. So it's very hard to see how any other Republican would go that route. And of course, they need 17, not 6. And it's not even clear all 6 of them would vote to convict. So, you know, it's unlikely to get there. They know that. And as Julie said, this is a political exercise.
You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll be back to talk more about this week's news after this.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Decades before the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, Marcus Garvey attracted millions of followers with a message of Black self-sufficiency and Black nationalism in Africa.
For our Black History Month special series, The Seismic Influence and Complicated Legacy of Marcus Garvey.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
This is the News Roundup. We're talking about the week's top headlines. Let's jump back into the conversation. Julie, let's go back now to the impeachment trial of former President Trump. We're getting a lot of listener questions about this, so I want to offer some clarification if we can. This news that was reported about 3 Republican senators, Lee, Graham, and Cruz, meeting with Donald Trump's defense team, what do we know about what happened and what unfolded at that meeting?
Sure. No, it makes a lot of sense why people would be confused or concerned about this, because this is presented as a trial, and you wouldn't normally have a situation where jurors in a criminal case, for example, would be meeting with the defense attorneys. That would be automatic grounds for dismissal of those jurors. I think what's important to remember here is that this is a political process. And as Anita mentioned before the break, we saw something similar happen with Mitch McConnell in the first impeachment trial, meeting with Trump's team. And these are senators who have made very clear that they are not persuadable. You know, they already know how they're going to vote on this going into the trial. They are in lockstep with the president, former president. They are in lockstep with the argument that his team is going to make. And so they see no downside, since they've already made that clear publicly and made it left no question about their impartiality here. They see no issue in going forward with a meeting like this. And frankly, there's no rule that actually bars them from doing so. The rules of impeachment are fairly vague. It's not a process that we obviously do very often in this country. And so you often see the rules kind of not quite made up as we go, but really being tested as we go. And at this point, there's no real punishment for what they are doing. They feel like this is fully appropriate, and they see no reason not to show their support for the former president.
Well, Julie, let me follow up with you about something we heard from that defense team, which was the opening argument made by one of Donald Trump's impeachment attorneys. That was Bruce Castor. He was widely criticized for it, even by folks on Fox News like Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham. And there were also reports that former President Trump was angered by that performance. What was going on in that opening statement?
Absolutely. This was something that the former president and also a lot of his allies on the Hill were quite concerned about. And a lot of it was more about presentation than just substance. The arguments were quite meandering. There was not a cohesiveness to them. There was a lot of kind of splintered arguments coming from Castor. And you know, the former president is somebody who is very attuned to the way that presentations roll out on television, of course. That is something we know from his presidency. And this was not polished and not cohesive, and he did not feel like he was getting a robust defense. The former president wants that. He doesn't want this to simply be a process argument about constitutionality. He wants a robust defense of his actions leading up to January 6th, and he did not feel as though he got that. Importantly, Republican senators, many of them, did not feel like they got that either. It didn't seem to change the way that they were leaning, but it did leave some of them with this feeling that it is harder for them to vote to acquit if the argument coming from the president's team is not cohesive.
So, Anita, what about today? What are you expecting to hear from Trump's defense team today?
Well, they've really had two arguments as they've gone forward, and one of them seems to be, already resolved. That was the issue we talked about earlier, which is this a constitutional proceeding? They are arguing that because President Trump is no longer president, he's no longer in office, that this is not a legitimate trial or impeachment proceeding. Again, as we mentioned earlier, they've already voted on that. So that seems to be, a moot point at this point. Today, we're going to see them talk about that, but we'll also hear them talk about how President Trump had the free speech right to speak at that protest, that he's protected by the First Amendment. And one of the things we expect them to do, or they had planned on doing, is to talk about other politicians, particularly Democrats, and how they've made comments, passionate comments at different events and rallies themselves, and that they were not, accused of inciting violence. They were not charged or investigated. And so they're going to say, look, why is this any different than anyone else? They had actually, his team has prepared a video. Again, we don't expect any witnesses today, but we do expect more video showing other politicians doing something similar. Now, you're going to hear the Democrats quickly say, well, look, violence violence didn't come from those speeches. But this is the time for the former president's team to make that argument. And so that's what we're going to hear today. Interestingly enough, they had 2 days to make their argument, and they say they'll only need today, 1 day.
So, Anita, we're getting a lot of questions about the process and how it could unfold, because as you and Julie have laid out, we haven't really seen an indication from a number of Republican senators that they would be likely to convict. Democrats would, of course, need 17 Republican votes to be able to do that. But Emily and Martin, two of our listeners, have tweeted, can you discuss the possibility of a secret vote on the impeachment? Martin, along similar lines, asks, how many would vote to convict Trump if the vote was anonymous? Anita, is there any possibility of that? Do we know what that could lead to?
Well, that's a great question, because I think, as Julie indicated before, some of them may be thinking, look, President Trump should be found guilty. But that's not what they're saying. And they are going to have this vote likely tomorrow on Saturday to talk about this. And it's not going to be a secret vote. We're going to know how they voted. And so it's not likely that we're going to see more than six Republicans vote to convict, and it's the same group that we have seen over and over, particularly these five Republicans that would be likely to do it. And President Trump knows he's going to lose a handful of Republicans, but he's pretty confident that they're not going to get a conviction.
Meanwhile, prosecutors in Georgia have opened a criminal investigation into former President Donald Trump. It stems from this phone call that he made last month to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger.
Look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have. So tell me, Brad, what are we going to do? We won the election, and it's not fair to take it away from us like this. And it's going to be very costly in many ways. And I think you have to say that you're going to reexamine it, and you can reexamine it, but reexamine it with people that want to find answers, not people that don't want to find answers.
Julie, tell us a little bit more about this investigation. What's the scope? What are prosecutors looking for?
Well, this is pretty fascinating because what it makes clear is that the investigations into the president's actions after the election and leading up to the 6th don't end with impeachment, that there actually could be a process, a criminal process to investigate his actions. And Georgia is really the first place where we are seeing this start to unfold. This investigation, as far as we are told from Georgia officials at this point, does focus on that phone call. We also know, though, that the president had several other conversations with people in Georgia, state officials, the governor, and others, and that other people around the former president had conversations as well. And I think that there is some question about whether this is going to be a criminal investigation that just focuses on former President Trump, whether it could bring in some of his lawyers, some of his advisors who were also engaged in that conversation. But I think the most important thing that I take away from it is the fact that this is not over. An acquittal in the impeachment trial sends a political message, but it does not necessarily absolve the president of some kind of criminal culpability with his actions leading up to the 6th.
So, Anita, what about that? This is a criminal investigation. Could Trump realistically face criminal consequences? What could those look like?
I mean, he could. That is what they're looking at. And I think it's also interesting that they focused on Georgia because, as we all know from various reporting, Georgia was not the only state where he pushed to change the election results. You know, Pennsylvania and other states where he made calls, where he had people come to the White House, you know, they could be looking at things too. You know, there's a variety of things that they're looking at in Georgia, a variety of crimes, and because they're looking at so many different calls and different actions that he took, it could be a variety of things. But it basically deals with state law, the solicitation of election fraud, the making of false statements to state and local government bodies. And interestingly, they've also are looking at a kind of racketeering or conspiracy charge. So all of those would depend on the investigation, who else was involved, what they find. We don't know. These are the things that they've indicated, that state officials have indicated in a letter that they're looking at. So it could narrow down. It could be very broad. At this point, we just don't know. But there are several different charges they would be looking at.
We should point out that former President Trump also suffered a setback in the digital space this week. In an interview with Twitter CFO Ned Siegel, CNBC's Becky Quick asked if the former president could return to the platform if he ran for office again.
So the way our policies work, when you're removed from the platform, you're removed from the platform, whether you're a commentator, you're a CFO, or you are a former or current public official. And so remember, our policies are designed to make sure that people are not inciting violence. And if anybody does that, we have to remove them from the service, and our policies don't allow people to come back.
So no.
He was removed when he was president, and that there'd be no difference for anybody who's a public official once they've been removed from the service.
Julie, how would a permanent Twitter ban affect Trump's future political ambitions?
Well, it's been fascinating to actually watch how the ban has already impacted him. It has taken away this major megaphone. You can only imagine what Trump would be doing during this trial if he had his Twitter account. It's very difficult for him to resist putting his real-time thoughts out there. And I do think it raises a question about his future going forward. He has signaled to advisors and allies that when the trial is done, he wants to be more vocal. He wants to get back out there. He certainly will be attempting to try to target the Republicans who will vote to convict him. But the question is how. Twitter was such a real-time, powerful megaphone for him. He, of course, could do television interviews. He, of course, could hold events. He could hold rallies across the country. But I do think that it lessens the immediacy of his reaction, and it does strip away one major power center for him. Certainly, if he were to go and run for president again, he'd have to figure out another way to communicate with the public. But I think it's really hard to imagine anything that can truly replicate the power and the velocity of his Twitter account.
Anita, on this question of the Twitter ban, and as Julie raises, President Trump, former President Trump, could be doing interviews. He could be holding rallies or events. He's not. And he also declined to testify in this trial. There is this question a lot of people are asking about, why haven't we seen him giving interviews to Fox News or calling into one of his favorite radio shows? Do we know why?
Yeah, it's been incredibly quiet, hasn't it, for the last, really, since he left on January 20th. You know, when in talking to his team and people close to him, they have urged him to take a break during the impeachment trial, up until the impeachment trial is over. And, you know, I think we've seen some reporting that he's been, you know, playing golf. He's down in Florida now, you know, doing different things. He's been in touch with advisors. He set up an office. And we have seen some statements come out of his office. But statements as a press release are very, very different than putting out a tweet. You know, it goes to a different audience and it's said in a different way. So we have not seen much. I do expect from the people that I've spoken to that after the impeachment trial is over, after perhaps a little break after that, that he will start doing that. But, you know, the people that I've talked to are worried about the Georgia case that we just talked about and other states that might be looking into other things. So, you know, there's some worry that if he does give an interview as opposed to, you know, just put out a statement, you know, he could get asked tough questions about those criminal investigations. He could say something that perhaps would affect that criminal investigation. So I think they're going to be very careful as to how he does it. I don't know that he's going to call into a TV network or a radio station like he used to do. One option is for him to do events where he's giving a speech but doesn't have to answer questions. But I do think you're going to see him back out there post-impeachment. I do think you'll see him want to be out there. He wants that attention back.
Before we go, I want to ask you both about some immigration news. The Biden administration is warning immigrants seeking entry to the U.S. to stay away from the southern border right now. Anita, just this morning, we saw an announcement from the Department of Homeland Security about a change to former President Trump's Remain in Mexico policy, or MPP, Migrant Protection Protocols program. What was that program? What did they change? What actually changes on the border right now?
Yeah, there's so many different policies that President Trump's team, his administration, put into place regarding immigration. You know, we heard about a lot of them over 4 years, but I think that people don't realize that there were so many smaller rules and regulations that maybe didn't get a lot of attention. And what the Biden team is learning is that it's taking time to understand all of them and, you know, reverse them or change them. What they announced this morning is that they're going to soon be allowing migrants into the U.S. who, because of a President Trump policy, have been forced to remain in Mexico while their asylum cases are processed. So this is good news for immigrants who have been worried about that, wondering about that. It's one step. There's still concern out there, and the White House press secretary mentioned it this week, that they are still looking at different things on the border, what they need to do. Of course, there's still concerns about the pandemic and who can enter the country and who's tested and all that sort of thing. But I think what we're starting to see is then trying to unravel what President Trump and his team put in place, which really restricted both legal and illegal immigration in this country.
Julie, just briefly, part of those restrictions, of course, were related to the pandemic, right? Border officials have used a section of the public health code to turn away most migrants and asylum seekers. Is that likely to change anytime soon?
Well, it's a great question because so much of the inflow from the border has been restricted just because of the pandemic and concerns about the virus spreading. And in some ways, it buys the Biden administration some time to figure out some of its own policies. It buys them a little bit of time to move some legislation toward Capitol Hill, though we expect that action on that legislation would be slow. But they know that they will have to deal with this question of what happens at the border when the pandemic begins to ease.
That was Julie Pace, Washington Bureau Chief with the Associated Press. Also with us, Anita Kumar, White House correspondent with Politico. Thanks to both of you for joining us today. Up next, we turn to COVID and bring in a health reporter to help us unpack some new guidance. We'll hear more from you and from our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
My name is Peter Sagal, and I'm here to interrupt your very serious NPR podcast to tell you about another NPR podcast, mainly mine, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Chances are that right now you're enjoying an earnest, serious treatment of some serious topic in the news or perhaps history or science. That's great, really. Well, that's not what we do, because people cannot live on serious alone. Listen now to the Wait, Don't Tell Me podcast from NPR.
Let's get back now to the news roundup. I'd like to bring in one more voice. Maggie Fox is the senior health editor at CNN. Maggie, welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Always nice to be with you.
Well, yesterday, President Biden announced that he'd purchased 200 million more doses of the COVID-19 vaccines. That will eventually bring the national supply up to 600 million doses. That's enough to vaccinate 300 million people by July. Maggie, Biden added he'd increase vaccine shipments to the states by more than 30%. What does that mean for the pace and supply of vaccinations this month compared to last?
Well, as it's clear that the pace and the rollout of the vaccines has been speeding up steadily even before President Biden took office. It's a matter of getting the manufacturing up to the level to where those vaccines can be shipped out as the states try to build up the infrastructure at the same time to deliver those vaccines. So there's two things going on. But Biden's already passed his hoped-for average of 1.5 million doses into arms every week now. So he's got that going. And once the Johnson & Johnson vaccine gets authorization from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which seems pretty likely, that will add even more vaccines into the mix. That's a one-dose vaccine, and that's one that doesn't have to be refrigerated, so that one might be usable in places that it's a little bit harder to ship these vaccines out to. So it's slow, but it's steady, and it looks like the vaccines will arrive to most corners of the U.S. by the summer.
So right now, about 260 million Americans are considered eligible to get a vaccine, right? But, you know, I should mention when I spoke with Andy Slavitt, who's a senior advisor to the White House COVID Task Force this week, he said pretty soon we will reach a tipping point when it's not people chasing vaccines, as it's still difficult to get a slot right now, but it will be vaccines chasing people. So we have any idea of when that demand and supply will level out?
It's not clear because the polls also indicate that the acceptance for vaccines is going up. In December, it was about 50% of people said they would get a vaccine. That's now up around 70%. So there's more people who are saying that they would like to get a vaccine. I think as people see that they're rolling out, there aren't any big disasters. People they know are being vaccinated and nothing's happening to them. Their healthcare providers are being vaccinated and are attesting to the vaccine's safety. And as we learn more about just how efficacious these vaccines are, and they seem to be very effective, the acceptance rate will go up even more. I also think there's a clamor, right? If people see there's a clamor for vaccines, they'll sort of think, well, what am I missing out on? Now, there is a hardcore of not only people who are completely against vaccines, but of vaccine skeptics. And those people will always be holdouts at the end. But right now, it looks like it's a moving target, and more people will be seeking that vaccine.
Well, one of President Biden's goals for his first 100 days is to reopen more than half of the country's elementary and middle schools. But a question is, how does he define reopen? At a press briefing on Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki explained that reopening means some teaching in classrooms at least one day a week. She followed up on that the next day.
From there, our objective, the president's objectives, is for all schools to reopen, to stay open, to be open 5 days a week, for kids to be learning. That's what our focus is on. This is simply a goal for 100 days.
Maggie, is there a little bit of a moving goalpost for the White House on this? What kind of pressure are they under to get schools back open?
Well, it's important to remember that the White House can't make schools reopen. This is something that is done at the state level and even at the county level. Individual school districts make these decisions. All the White House can do is offer guidance. And today we're going to hear from the CDC a little bit later about what they think schools will need to do in order to reopen safely. And that's the issue. It's what schools can do that is safe. And different schools have different facilities for doing that. A school that's well off, where the parents can ferry their children back and forth in cars, where they have plenty of classrooms so they can space the students out, where they can supply masks to the students, where they have plenty of staff to clean the rooms, where they've got great ventilation systems, those schools can reopen more safely. But schools that are poorer, in poorer school districts, that are more crowded, where the children have to ride buses to schools, where there's crowded classrooms, where there are fewer teachers, where they've got ancient ventilation systems, those schools are going to find it a lot harder to reopen safely. So there is going to be a lot of variation across the country. The best the federal government and the CDC can do is tell them, this is what you need to do in order to open safely, and then hopefully provide some of the supplies, some of the backup that's needed to help those school districts do that.
Well, you mentioned it is a state decision, in many cases a county decision. Do we have a sense, especially after this last week, of exactly how much progress has been made in reopening schools nationwide? And do we have any idea what's in that new CDC guidance coming out today?
A little bit is leaked down. It is common sense stuff. You're not going to hear any surprises from the CDC. They're obviously going to say kids need to wear masks while they're in school. They're going to say kids need to be spaced out while they're in school. Children need to wash their hands frequently while they're in school. There might be some ideas about perhaps staggering days so that the classrooms aren't full. We know what you need to do to not pass along this virus. It's not very hard. You wear a mask, you make sure there's plenty of ventilation in a room, you don't put people closely together, and you make sure that things can be kept clean. In schools, that's a challenge, of course, because kids gather together and they clump, they play, they touch. But there's plenty of studies that have shown that when the schools do all of these things, there's very little transmission in the schools. They've been able to track the few cases that turn up in kids, and it looks like they caught the virus in the community, not in their school. Now, some states have gone farther towards opening their schools than others. Florida is almost open completely, and they say they have had very little trouble with that. Florida is a state with nice weather. The kids can be outside a lot. They can have recess. So it might be a little easier for a state like Florida to reopen than it would for a state like Maine to reopen their schools.
Well, speaking of guidelines from the CDC, this week we should mention they released new research that found double masking does offer more protection against the coronavirus. Here's CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky.
In the breathing experiment, having both the source and the receiver wear masks modified to fit better reduced the receiver's exposure by more than 95% compared to no mask at all.
Maggie, Dr. Walensky said modified there. Tell us more about the science. What modifications is she talking about that make masks more effective?
Well, everybody hears the word double masking and they think, well, if I put two masks on, I'm good. And that is not what they're talking about. What they're talking about is a way of affixing these masks to your face so that you have a really good seal. Because, of course, the problem with masks is they're hard to breathe through. And if they're not sealed against your face all the way around, the air is going to leak in and out at the sides. So you're going to breathe in germs and you're going to breathe out germs. So the CDC was really careful in describing what they're talking about with double masking. And this is like a surgical style mask underneath with a really good filter on it to filter out the particles. And then over the top, a mask that fits very tightly and very well, making a seal, holding that surgical mask against your face so that when you breathe, you're breathing in and out through those layers of fabric. And there are some little tricks you can do to make it fit against your face better, like tying a knot in front of your ear. And if you go to the CDC website, they have a careful illustration showing you how to do that. You can't just kind of sling a knot in there and wish for the best. So it's a careful calculation of how to do this.
But Maggie, there's also the question of at this point in the pandemic, there are still people who are reluctant to wear one mask. And there are some elected officials among them. This week, there was a photo that went viral of South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem not only not wearing a mask, but also hanging out with 25 of her legislative pages. And I think only one of them had a mask on at the time. There is some reluctance in the American public, right? So how, Maggie, can the federal government get those folks on board, especially when they see some of their own leaders not masking?
Reluctance is an understatement. There are people who are outright hostile to wearing masks. And there's probably at this point not a whole lot the federal government can do, because these are quarters that are going to be not receptive to a message from a Democratic president. I've talked to people who are in state government across the country and in some of the red states. Not only is masking people reluctant to mask, they actively discourage it, and it's kind of a badge of honor to be seen not wearing your mask. It was hoped that perhaps a new administration would give governors some cover to encourage people to wear masks. That doesn't seem to have happened everywhere. The only thing that's possible is that when people see that the states where people wear masks have much lower rates of transmission, that message will get through to governors. But even under the Trump administration, Dr. Deborah Birx was going from state to state and telling governors this, and they still wouldn't do it. So we've got a big divide in our country, and that's one of the big problems. Double masking. The people who are going to double mask are the people who are wearing masks anyway. I don't know what people can do to get the people who are against masking to adopt the use of masks.
Maggie, we've seen recent declines in hospitalizations and daily deaths and confirmed new infections from COVID-19. But looming over all of that progress are more contagious coronavirus variants. Maggie, when you look at those case numbers, they are down, but they're still way higher than they were last summer. Where, big picture, is the U.S. right now in the fight against COVID-19? Do you think we're turning a corner?
Well, Amna, definitely cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are going down. But as you pointed out, they're going down from a really high point. I mean, we're still at a much higher point than we were in the spring and summer when it seemed pretty bad. So we've got a long way to go. But it does seem like Americans are starting to do some of the things they should do, that some of these behaviors are having an effect. People not traveling, people not gathering in big groups, people wearing masks in the places where people do wear masks. There are some worrying signs because some governors are kind of loosening up restrictions as they see these numbers come down. And there are experts who are worried that might be a little bit too soon, opening restaurants for Valentine's Day. It'll be really interesting to see what happens after this weekend, because it seems like a lot of mayors and governors felt sorry for the restaurants and thought they should let them open for this special holiday. But like the governor of South Dakota, you know, having these parties, people are starting to have parties and weddings. And we know that those are the super spreader events that seed the virus through the community again. And there is a lot of worry that these more contagious variants, well, they're easier to catch. I mean, if you got exposed to the currently circulating virus, you may or may not catch it. If you get exposed to some of these new variants, you're more likely to catch them. You're less likely to get away with an exposure, so to speak.
Maggie, folks really have a lot of questions about vaccine access, and I just don't think we can get them enough information. So I want to put to you one of our emails from a listener named Rich, who says, I wish I knew when peons like me will get our COVID vaccines. It seems like people like me are somewhere below the Cub Scouts in order of importance. Maggie, what can we tell folks like Rich about when there will be enough vaccine that anyone who wants one out there could get one?
Well, I'm one of those peons, too. I'm probably in the last group to get vaccines, except for children. They're probably the very last group. The estimates are that by April, there should be pretty good production and pretty good rollout. And now President Biden is promising that by the summer, there will be enough vaccines available for anyone who wants one to get one. Now, there is still a disconnect between having those vaccines in production and having them out there in the pharmacies, in the doctor's offices, in the grocery stores where people can get them. Here's the problem. State public health departments have been neglected for 15 years and longer, so they don't have the infrastructure to deliver these vaccines. That's part of the problem. There aren't enough people to put these vaccines into arms. And so the answer isn't clear, and it varies from state to state and county to county. You can't give everybody like Rich across the country the same answer.
Maggie, you mentioned children, and we should remind folks that young children were excluded from the original U.S. clinical trials. But in a ProPublica interview earlier this week, Dr. Fauci said children as young as first graders may be able to get the vaccine by the start of school in September if the clinical trials they're currently part of are successful. Maggie, what can you tell us about the clinical trials specifically for children and the vaccine?
Well, Pfizer's the farthest ahead on this. They've been testing their vaccine in children as young as 12. And I talked to one of the 12-year-olds in one of the trials, and they're very eager to get the vaccine. And the way it works is you test these vaccines in older adults because we do value our children, and we try not to expose our children to anything new until we absolutely have to. And you go into younger and younger groups. And Pfizer's about ready to move into a younger group now. Moderna is just behind them in testing vaccines in children. It's a quicker process than testing in adults. So they pretty much just have to show safety and some quick indication of efficacy. And since it's been proven to be so safe in adults, it should be pretty easy to roll these out to younger children.
And Maggie, there was some news on the effect for pregnant women as well. What do we know?
Well, they weren't specifically tested in pregnant women, but there were some pregnant women in the trials, tens of thousands of pregnant women in the trials, it turns out, and there are no safety indications there. It seems to be safe for pregnant women, but the advice is for a woman who's pregnant to talk to her doctor about whether she should get the vaccine.
Talk to your doctor. Always good advice. Maggie Fox, thank you so much for being with us. Maggie Fox is senior health editor with CNN. Also with us today, Anita Kumar, White House correspondent with Politico, and Julie Pace, Washington bureau chief with the Associated Press. Thank you to all of you for joining us today. Remember, we're on Instagram. You can follow us at The 1A Show. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett, Mike Kidd, and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. Stay with us for the international segment of our news roundup after this. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
It's time for the news roundup, and it's been another very busy week. The Summer Games in Tokyo face further turmoil. Tennis fans have now been barred from the Australian Open, and China pulls the plug on the BBC. All our biggest international stories fall under these three categories: calls, crackdowns, and COVID. Our guests today are Dave Lawler, World News Editor for Axios. Dave, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
Jennifer Williams is the Senior Foreign Editor at Vox. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And David Rennie is the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. David, always a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Hello.
So President Biden says his first official phone call with Chinese President Xi Jinping lasted two straight hours. Dave Lawler, clearly they had a lot to talk about. What do we know about this call?
Yes, we know they discussed Hong Kong, the apparent genocide in Xinjiang, China's aggression toward Taiwan, trade disputes, a lot of thorny topics to get through. They also discussed nuclear weapons, climate change, and the pandemic. So no wonder it took 2 hours, I suppose. Biden emerged from that call, was asked about it the next day, and said, if we don't start moving, they're going to eat our lunch, referring to China. And actually, his advisors did a briefing ahead of the call about how he would be approaching China. And basically, they said he accepts Donald Trump's proposition of all-out competition with China across technology, trade, security. But they think Trump went about it the wrong way with his America First approach, but a lot more focus on competition than cooperation so far from Biden on China.
Well, and Joe Biden and Xi Jinping know each other pretty well. Biden was speaking to CBS News this week, and he had this to say about his Chinese counterpart.
He's very bright. He's very tough. He doesn't have, and I don't mean as a criticism, just a reality, he doesn't have a democratic small d bone in his body. we need not have a conflict, but there's going to be an extreme competition. I'm not going to do it the way Trump did. We're going to focus on international rules of the road.
David Rennie, what would you tell us about the relationship between these two and how that's viewed from China?
Well, President Biden is right. He does know Xi Jinping pretty well for world leaders. There's no kind of getting to know you period. This is because when Xi Jinping was still vice president, but we knew he was going to get the top job, President Obama sent his vice president, who is the kind of the equal opposite number, to spend a lot of time with him, dozens and dozens of hours on trips. What's interesting is that you now have President Biden sort of stressing how he understood how tough Xi Jinping was. The truth is that there was also an element of kind of probably excessive optimism on the American side at the time, because the current Chinese leader at that time, Hu Jintao, was just this absolute robotically disciplined communist technocrat who would wake his way through the talking points, and you just couldn't have a substantive conversation with him. So I have spoken to people who were in the room for those Biden-Xi meetings back in 2011, 2012, and they'll say there was real interest and almost excitement about this guy who was very tough but very candid, would talk about how there were problems inside China's own system, how hard it was to get communist officials to do what they were told, how corruption was kind of killing their own system. And this was a sense of this was a politician willing to kind of talk and engage as a politician. I think what we've now realized, and you see that reflected in President Biden's recent comments to CBS, is that that confidence and that kind of political swagger has actually is a very sort of dark, hardline, authoritarian, strongman swagger. And so I think there's a kind of new sense of realism about what they're dealing with.
Well, Jen, let me put to you what one of our listeners is tweeting. Lourdes tweets about the call saying, quote, "Biden calling Xi was a mistake. By calling first, he showed weakness." What do you make of that?
Well, you know, they have to have a conversation at some point. They are, you know, the leaders of the two biggest global economies. There was no chance they were not going to speak. Someone's got to pick up the phone. But I think the reality here is, you know, first of all, this wasn't the first call that Biden made, right? He waited pretty substantially a while before, you know, talking to Xi, reaching out to U.S. traditional allies, Canada, allies in Europe. So that in and of itself made quite a statement. But I think what's really interesting, too, here, especially in comparison to Donald Trump, you know, one of the issues and the problems that we had during the Trump era was that Donald Trump didn't have these existing relationships or any experience with diplomacy or, you know, basically meeting with world leaders outside of kind of business arrangements. And he was very easily talked into things when he spoke to world leaders. He would often take their side when they explained things. And according to John Bolton, who was Trump's national security advisor, according to his book, when Trump was meeting with Xi Jinping at one point during the during his administration, Xi Jinping brought up Xinjiang and the camps for the Uyghurs and the indoctrination camps. And according to Bolton, which, you know, take it for what you will, John Bolton has his own agenda. But according to Bolton, Trump essentially told Xi that he was doing the right thing, that was the right thing to do. And we're talking about putting, you know, committing essentially cultural genocide. So the fact that Biden is not going to be talked into things like that, that Biden has kind of a clear-eyed sense of who Xi Jinping is, in and of itself is a really kind of positive development in any way you look at it from the Trump administration.
Dave Lawler, we also heard from President Biden visiting the Pentagon this week, announcing the creation of a China task force. Do we have much detail on what that entails and what it is?
So basically, they're going to take the next 3 or 4 months, work with people across the Defense Department. And by the way, they're doing a similar process on trade to review all of the policies on China and come up with some kind of lasting strategy when it comes to China. And again, this is very much coming from a perspective of competing with China, of, you know, what is China developing and how do we counter that? And so, yeah, they're going to do that in the defense space. They're doing it in the trade space. And there's talk of placing investments in technology as well to make sure that they're staying ahead of what China is doing.
Well, this week, international experts investigating the origins of COVID-19 all but dismissed a popular conspiracy theory that the virus came from a laboratory in China.
We did not find evidence of large outbreaks that could be related to cases of COVID-19 in Wuhan or elsewhere.
That was Peter Ben Mbarek, who led the World Health Organization's mission to Wuhan. Jen, it does seem remarkable that we still aren't 100% sure where this virus came from. What do we know, and what is the likeliest source?
Right. That's actually the, I think, one of the most important things to come out of this is that, you know, at the end of this, that these, this group that included 17 researchers from China, 17 international scientists, they spent weeks basically, you know, interviewing staff at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, going, meeting with, you know, patients and doctors, going to the wet market where, you know, one of the potential sources for where the virus emerged came out. And after all of that, they essentially acknowledged that their investigation hadn't really dramatically changed the picture that they had beforehand of what had happened. And, you know, that's really important. A number of scientists who looked into this had already essentially dismissed the lab leak theory, essentially saying that, you know, that theory saying that the virus had leaked or, you know, potentially been deployed on purpose, you know, from this high containment lab. They've said that there's no evidence so far that happened. But again, it's really important to understand that there are still big holes in what we do actually know. The investigation, WHO investigation's fuller report, is expected soon. But basically what they think so far is that the most likely pathway for the coronavirus was a crossover into humans from an intermediary species. But again, still a lot we don't know. They said themselves that this hypothesis requires, quote, more studies and more specific targeted research. They also acknowledge that they're not totally sure that they were given all of the information and given quite the access, you know. So again, we're still missing a lot of information.
Well, David, you wrote recently about another part of China I want to ask you about. It's not well known to most Americans. It's near the Chinese border with North Korea. That's where the country's Korean ethnic minority lives. You did visit there recently. What did you find? What should we know?
Well, I went there because, I mean, we've seen it in Tibet, we've seen it in Xinjiang, much better known areas of kind of ethnic discontent, where the Chinese central leadership has decided that it is time to rein in the sort of the language learning, bilingual schools, privileges, and some degree of kind of cultural autonomy for its minorities, and to make everyone speak the same language, Mandarin, tell everyone that they are Chinese, and to really try and limit the ability of minorities to have their own kind of expression. I went to Yanbian because it's fewer than a million people. It's not, as you say, well known, but it was a model minority. It's a bit of a dreadful phrase, but literally, you know, Chinese educationists would go and study bilingual, trilingual education in Yanbian, where they were learning Korean and Chinese and English. It worked so well. The Korean minority was so peaceful and contented. And then just recently got slapped with this extremely aggressive ruling by the Chinese leadership, saying that their language laws, which had existed for 60 years, were unconstitutional and were a threat to national security. And you see that if it's got to that most peaceful and sleepy of minority areas, you realize that essentially this desire for a completely Chinese sort of monocultural communist-led society has kind of reached the end of the line. That's why I went to this place.
It's a fascinating look at a part of China we don't hear much about. One other piece of news from China that's currently about 1.4 million miles away from the country. After a seven-month journey, China's Tianwen-1 mission is now orbiting Mars. It joins one other spacecraft from the United Arab Emirates. A rover from NASA is en route and expected to land on the red planet next Thursday. Well, last week, we told you about a coup happening in Myanmar. This week, the Biden administration has responded with sanctions on some of those responsible. Jen, bring us up to speed. What did the Biden administration do, and why does it matter?
Sure. So speaking at the White House on Wednesday, Biden essentially detailed sort of a three-pronged response that his administration is going to be pursuing in response to the coup in Myanmar. The first was an executive order imposing sanctions on the very military leaders who organized and launched the coup, their business interests, their family members, and they're going to be identifying additional targets specifically in the coming days. The second part is they're blocking the regime from accessing roughly $1 billion held in the U.S., they're going to continue U.S. funding for civil society groups and things like that, but they're blocking the actual assets the regime holds in the U.S. And finally, they're imposing new export controls and freezing some other unnamed assets that could benefit the military-led government. So it's a really, you know, it's both a really important step in terms of, you know, it's symbolic, it's not nothing, but it's also not necessarily something that's going to turn the tide or induce the ruling junta to actually change course here. Biden did call on the regime to release Aung San Suu Kyi and the other, you know, pro-democracy officials. But again, the U.S. doesn't have a ton of leverage beyond these kinds of sanctions. The U.S. doesn't give a ton of foreign aid to Myanmar as it is. So when it comes to cutting that off, it's not a huge slap on the wrist. Additionally, a lot of U.S. allies in the region, specifically, you know, Japan, South Korea, have become really close trading partners with Myanmar and are unlikely to want to, you know, very happily join on to any kind of major sanction actions because they want to continue that trade relationship. So, again, while it's a good thing and it's a significant step, there are still really big questions about how much this will actually achieve.
Well, David, what about on the ground in Myanmar? Jen mentioned, of course, Aung San Suu Kyi remains detained. What more do we know about how that coup has unfolded on the ground?
Well, today we had some very large protests, the largest so far. We had 100,000 people, more than 100,000 people in the main city, Yangon. They were peaceful, thank goodness, because we have had reports, including kind of photographic evidence of the security forces using live ammunition against protesters. That was something that was raised by Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, about violence against protesters. So there is a sense that resistance has not been crushed. There is a sense that a very large number of people of different groups are outraged by the coup, essentially caused by the military suspending parliament after they lost an election, because the party that backs the military lost this election, and they took Aung San Suu Kyi into detention. But of course, as Jen says, the world's leverage, you know, American leverage, the West leverage, is limited in all kinds of horrible ways. One is that Aung San Suu Kyi, who used to be this great human rights icon, of course, is a very tarnished idol now because she has given support to the real repression of the Muslim minority, the Rohingyas, in Myanmar, in a way that's gravely disappointed the world. And also, isolating Myanmar isn't possible when China is waiting in the wings, ready to take over. Myanmar is quite suspicious of China. They do a lot of trade with China. They're allowing China to build their infrastructure. They don't want to become owned by or a colony of China. But if the West isolates Myanmar, that's going to push them into the arms of the Chinese. And you see in this new world that we live in, where the West gets tough, China is waiting as an alternative right on the border.
Well, David, I should put to you one of our listener comments coming in now. Jean has emailed saying, I find it difficult to have sympathy for supposed pro-democracy protesters in Myanmar. Where was their outrage in response to the genocide of the Rohingya people? They've suffered for years at the hands of the military. Even though they were born there, they've lived in Myanmar for generations. You mentioned Aung San Suu Kyi, of course, her reputation, as you said, being tarnished for not responding to that oppression of the Rohingya. Has that affected how the rest of the world is responding?
Absolutely, because essentially Aung San Suu Kyi, in order to become the de facto leader, sided with a very ugly strain of nationalism and Buddhist chauvinism, anti-Muslim chauvinism. A lot of Buddhist monks have been involved in this. A lot of Burmese from Myanmar will tell you that the Rohingya are nothing to do with them. They're immigrants who came as a result of the British Empire a very long time ago. The world is a messy place. There are people who are liberal Democrats who hate a military junta, but who are also racist and chauvinist. And I wish the world were a less messy place, but I think we need to fix on the fact that at least we can say with confidence that the same people massacring the Rohingya just caused a coup, and we have to try and bend our minds to trying to put some pressure on them.
Under the theme of the world is a messy place. Meanwhile, there was a protest in Poland that also caught America's attention this week. Independent media outlets blacked out their screens and their pages on Wednesday to protest a new advertising tax they say is an attack on press freedom. David, bring us up to speed. What's going on there in Poland?
So Poland is one of the classic countries. You know, remember the Solidarity protests and Lech Walesa, you know, a place where, you know, the Soviet yoke was thrown off. Since then, it has become one of the countries, along with, say, Hungary particularly, where illiberal democratic governments are stretching the definition of what it means to be a democracy. And Law and Justice, the very hardline, very conservative ruling party since 2015, has decided in the name of funding the health system during this current COVID crisis to levy an advertising levy on advertising revenue for media. It's being dressed up by the Prime Minister as a way to defend the little guy, the Polish media, from the sort of Facebooks of this world, the foreigners. But that is belied by the fact that the most distinguished sort of press outlets like Rzeczpospolita, the main centrist paper, or Gazeta Wyborcza, the main liberal paper, basically blacked out their websites for 24 hours. Independent TV and radio went black screens, were running recorded messages saying your favorite program was supposed to be here but can't be, as a protest to try and warn the Polish people that this new tax, they believe, is designed to crush independent media in Poland, which is another kind of blow to freedom and democracy in Eastern Europe.
Well, what are, David, just to follow up on that, what are those broader concerns? Because as you mentioned, this is only a proposed tax on independent media sources. What's the concern about where this goes from here?
Well, the concerns are that the current government, I mean, for one thing, it's a lot of money. It's going to raise more than $200 million a year. And the Polish media, like so many other European media, you know, they're really, really struggling. And some of them will simply go to the wall. It's also the case that Law and Justice have poured money into state media, and state media is now, you know, a sort of laughing stock among Poles because it resembles the old kind of bad days of the communists, just pro-government propaganda. And in December, you saw a very dodgy deal where a very large regional company, Polska Media, which owns 20 of the 24 regional newspapers, was bought by a state-controlled oil refiner, and now has essentially fallen into the hands of the government, rather reminiscent of what we've seen in Hungary with Viktor Orban. And this is all happening within the borders of the European Union. So a massive challenge to other European powers. How do you deal with one of your own at the table when they're heading in this illiberal direction?
Well, after nearly 3 years in prison, Saudi women's rights activist Loujain Al-Hathloul is back home. Jen, remind us who Loujain is and why she's important in Saudi Arabia.
Sure. So as you said, she's been in prison for nearly 3 years. She is a human rights activist who fought for the women's right to drive in Saudi Arabia, as well as, you know, to get rid of other kind of legal restrictions on women under this guardianship system under Saudi law that essentially says that, you know, a male guardian, either, you know, your father or your husband or your eldest brother, has essentially legal control over everything you do, has to, you know, sign off on any time you travel abroad, anything like that. So she essentially rose to prominence for challenging the ban on driving and these other restrictions. And she basically became a household name in 2014 when she tried to drive her car across the border from the United Arab Emirates into Saudi Arabia. She was promptly arrested. She was held for over 70 days. And that really brought her to prominence. She was then arrested again in 2018, a couple times. While she was held, she has since told relatives that she and several other activists, she's not the only activist, by the way, she is one of the most prominent, but there are many women activists who have fought for this. She said that, you know, they had been detained in a private facility where they were tortured and sexually harassed. So, you know, she has become kind of the figure of this. But what's really remarkable and what really angered people was that she was still in jail in June 2018 when they lifted the driving ban. So they lifted the thing that she had been advocating for, you know, for, and they didn't let her out. And so that's one of the kind of big outrages. So they finally sentenced her in December. Basically, the way they did it is to kind of make it so that she would just so happen to be released right in the early weeks of the Biden administration, very much meant to be a strategic kind of move, sort of a gesture of goodwill, saying that, you know, we are committed to human rights, to the Biden administration, knowing that that's going to be a big issue for them. But she's not free quite yet. She still will face 3 years probation and a 5-year ban on traveling outside of Saudi Arabia. And she's basically said the fight's not over.
Dave Lawler on this issue of the timing. As Jen mentions, Loujain Al-Hathloul was released in the early weeks of the Biden administration. Do we know how much pressure the Biden administration put on Saudi officials to release her, and why she was released right now?
So Lu Jane's siblings did a press conference yesterday, and they were asked that question, and they said they don't think it's a coincidence that she was held during the Trump administration, which they didn't feel put a lot of pressure on the Saudis on human rights, and that shortly after Biden came into power, their sister was released. And on the same day that she was released, the Saudi foreign minister also met with Biden's new envoy for Yemen and sent a clear signal that they're prepared to work with the United States to try to end the war there. And so clearly the Saudis have heard what Joe Biden said on the campaign trail. He referred to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia as a pariah at one point. And he's already taken steps like freezing an arms deal with Saudi Arabia. So they've seen all that. They're trying to avert a crisis with the Biden administration off the bat. And it seems like human rights and Yemen are two areas where they think they need to kind of show the right signals early on to maybe reduce some of those tensions with the Biden administration.
Well, David, you think back to the relationship under the Trump administration. We know it was very clearly messaged there was a close relationship between Mohammed bin Salman and with Jared Kushner, who was senior advisor to President Trump. What does all of this right now say, the meeting with the Yemen envoy, the release of Lu Jane al-Hathloul, what does it say about what we can expect from the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia under the Biden administration?
Yeah, I think the Saudis cannot expect to have a direct line into the Oval Office through communications with Jared Kushner in particular. They're no longer. Saudi Arabia was the first country that Trump visited as president. So they were very much at the top of the list of countries that the U.S. was ready to work with, particularly on the Iran issue. Now Saudi Arabia is back in the queue a little bit. And look, Democrats have been putting a lot of pressure on Saudi Arabia since the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in particular. And Biden is basically picking up where they left off. Now, he's, you know, a more cautious figure than some on the left that would like to see the relationship with Saudi Arabia really downsized. Biden appreciates the importance of working with Saudi Arabia, and he's worried about Iran as well. So there's it's not going to be an end to the relationship as we know it, I don't think. But it's certainly a much more diminished Saudi Arabia in Washington these days than the stature that they had under Donald Trump.
Well, you did mention the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And so I should ask, is there any indication that there will be some kind of response from the Biden administration for Saudi Arabia after that? I mean, there was a clear link between Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and that murder. And the Trump administration really did not seem to address it. What do we know about the impact of that in this administration?
So they have said Avril Haines, who's the new director of national intelligence, has said that the U.S. will release an intelligence report on the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And it's believed that that report draws a direct line to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. So if that report does become public, I think that will once again make this a top issue of concern. And it's really an issue that the Saudis would like the world to move on from. But I think Biden is not quite ready to do that yet.
Jen, what about you? I want to get your take on this. More broadly speaking, what do you expect to see in the way of public pressure, but also what's unfolding behind the scenes when it comes to the U.S. and Saudi Arabia for the next 3 years?
So one of the big things you have to think about is, you know, how much the Biden administration is interested in pursuing kind of rejoining or reconstituting the Iran deal. That is going to play in, you know, big time when it comes to the relationship with Saudi Arabia, right? If you remember, during the Obama administration, the primary reason that the Obama administration backed the Saudi war in Yemen was because they essentially wanted to get the Saudis to stop vocally complaining about the Iran deal, right? Saudi and Iran have been fighting proxy wars for a long time for dominance of the region. And Saudi was very unhappy that it seemed that there was an opening from the U.S. administration to Iran. We're going to see similar kind of tensions play out here. So I think, you know, as much as the Biden administration wants to push Saudi on human rights issues, it is clearly having to try to balance that to make sure that Saudi still remains on side for other issues. I mean, you've seen that when, you know, the Biden administration has been talking about pushing Saudi on the war in Yemen and ending U.S. support. They've also, you know, in the same breath said, you know, we value our, you know, close intelligence ties with the Saudis. We're going to continue to provide them defensive support, very much making clear that they still need the Saudis on side. So I think that's one dynamic to really keep an eye on going forward in the next months and years.
We're going to press pause here for just a moment. And as we do, tributes are being paid to Flory Jagoda. Born in Sarajevo, she survived the Holocaust and brought the traditional ballads of her ancestors and the melodies of the Ladino language to American audiences. Flori Jagoda was 97. Well, on Monday, South Africa announced it was suspending its rollout of the AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine. A small clinical trial revealed the shot provided only minimal protection from the virus variant that's widely circulating in the country. Professor Salim Abdul Karim, co-chair South Africa's Ministerial Advisory Committee on COVID-19.
We don't want to end up with a situation where we vaccinated 1 million people or 2 million people with a vaccine that may not be effective in preventing hospitalization and severe disease.
Dave Lawler, I think the news from South Africa really spooked a lot of people. How much do we know about why they've paused right now?
Right. We've had so much good news about vaccines, and this is a particularly worrying one. So the AstraZeneca vaccine doesn't appear to be effective at preventing people from, you know, getting symptomatic cases of coronavirus in South Africa, where this new variant is the dominant strain. We don't yet have the full picture about whether it prevents severe cases of coronavirus. And we have seen other vaccines, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and one from Novavax, that were doing trials in South Africa. Similarly, they're much less effective against the South African variant, but there is some indication that they may prevent the most severe forms of the disease. So this doesn't mean that, you know, this variant makes vaccines entirely ineffective, but it's really the worst piece of data we've seen so far about this idea that variants may really complicate the vaccination picture going forward.
Well, Jen, when you take a step back and look at the healthcare system in South Africa, there are estimates that suggest 80% of the population there can't afford private healthcare, right? They rely on state hospitals. Those hospitals are currently overstretched. What does all this mean for COVID-19 on the ground in South Africa right now?
Well, it's really, really bad news. There's really no other way to explain it. They've said that they're going to continue, you know, the vaccine rollout, first of all, was supposed to start this week. So they stopped it right before it was about to start. They've now said they're going to continue with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which the health minister has said that that one has been proven more effective against the South African variant. But here's the problem. They already have 1.5 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine sitting there. They have 1 million so far. The 500,000 are supposed to be delivered later this month. But that's a problem. They have all these vaccines that are now just sitting there that they've decided they're not going to use because they're not effective, which means they've spent all this money. They have all these doses. And so the question here now is, well, what are they going to do with all of that? They've talked about several options, including selling them or maybe trying to swap them with countries who are dealing with, the more kind of earlier coronavirus strains. The problem is, they have to run up against time, right? These vaccines do expire. And the second thing is that, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which they're wanting to replace it, getting people to trade for that may be really difficult, because if you remember, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, unlike the AstraZeneca vaccine, is a single dose. It's also cheaper, and it's much easier to be distributed because it doesn't need those deep freezers that the AstraZeneca vaccine needs, which means, it could be very difficult to convince other countries to swap for a much more difficult to distribute, much more expensive vaccine if they have the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So it's a huge logistical problem on top of, the kind of fears about the actual virus itself, right? They had this huge system that they're about to set up to roll out these vaccines, and now they're stuck with all of this stuff that they don't know what to do with and trying to figure out how to replace that with the vaccines that do work. And, healthcare workers are just demoralized and just in shock over this, because they were really hoping that this vaccine rollout was going to start helping them get a control of this virus. And now it just is like another blow.
It's not great news in South Africa on the COVID-19 front. Meanwhile, in Tanzania, the government hasn't updated the country's COVID case numbers since last May. The country's president is perhaps the world's most powerful vaccine skeptic. He believes COVID in his country has been, quote, removed by the powers of God. Matsidiso Moeti is the World Health Organization's regional director for Africa, who spoke this week to CNN. She says the data proves otherwise.
I'm afraid we have had evidence from cross-border testing in the neighborhood of Tanzanian people who have been found to be COVID positive. And we would like to advise that and have urged the country to work on acquiring the vaccine for its population.
Dave Lawler, what do we know about what's happening and what leaders on the ground in Tanzania really believe? Do they take COVID seriously?
So Tanzania officially declared victory over COVID, as you mentioned. Doctors who are treating COVID aren't allowed to log cases as COVID, even when they're confident that's the case. It's written down as some active pneumonia. So it's a state of denial officially, although the people of Tanzania, or many of the people of Tanzania, are clearly aware that this virus is spreading. The president has recommended everything from steam treatments to a smoothie that involves ginger and onion and a few other ingredients to ward off COVID. And as you mentioned, he has said that Tanzania doesn't need vaccines and has also said that the vaccines themselves don't work. So this is a, it's a very unfortunate case. Actually, there are a couple other countries that have declared victory over COVID. North Korea says it doesn't have any cases, and Turkmenistan, but both of them are accepting vaccines. So Tanzania is really the outlier that is not only saying it has no cases, it's saying it doesn't need the vaccines either.
Well, Dave, what about Tanzania's neighbors? I mean, we've heard again and again, the virus does not respect borders, right? So is there any pressure from them, any reaction from them to this denial in Tanzania?
Yeah, there's deep concerns. The African CDC has publicly called on Tanzania, to act basically more responsibly as a neighbor to the countries. And we don't know the scale of the outbreak in Tanzania, whether this is something that is going to cause a problem across the African continent from people leaving Tanzania. But it is certainly, it's one of those many things that as you look in the sort of the medium and long term of how we move away from this pandemic, countries that don't have access to the vaccine is a big problem, but a country that is saying we don't want the vaccine at all, that's a pretty troubling problem to solve.
Well, Jen, Dave just mentioned we don't really know the picture on the ground in Tanzania. We do know what's happening inside the U.S. Embassy. The U.S. Embassy in Tanzania has said COVID cases there have recently spiked. How is it possible for any country at this point to simply just deny what's going on all around them?
That's a fabulous question, and I don't actually have a good answer for you. It is just, honestly, it's criminal, I think, at this point, to have world leaders denying that COVID-19 is active in their countries, not, ordering vaccines. I mean, even Jair Bolsonaro, for all of his sins, and he has many in Brazil, he has said that you shouldn't get the vaccine unless you want it. He's said he's not going to get the vaccine, but he's still allowed his government to pursue vaccines and even thanked China for sending, its vaccine there. So, he's probably one of the most prominent kind of COVID deniers and downplayers, and at least he is still allowing, vaccinations to go forward. The fact that the president of Tanzania is doing this is just staggering. And it's a really, interesting political question beyond the obvious, health and human rights and awful violations here. The leader of the biggest political opposition party has been calling him out publicly on Twitter and saying, Tanzanians have the right to vaccinations, called the rulers the conspiracy theorists, and said, we have a right to do this. This is unacceptable. The recent election was contested. So I think it'll be interesting to see if this does help enable some of the opposition to maybe challenge the president's leadership. But something's got to give. There are people that are clearly dying, and the fact that they are doing nothing and actively working against having vaccines is just unconscionable.
Well, speaking of false and dangerous information, on Monday, Facebook said it would expand a list of false health claims banned from the platform. The site has struggled with misinformation for years now, and it's still riddled with debunked claims that vaccines are toxic or they cause autism. Jen, we saw Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok all recently trying to scrub promotional clips of a film called Planet Lockdown. They do make a lot of money off their content. What do you make of this whole kind of whack-a-mole response they have right now?
Well, it's really difficult. The platform and the system that they have built is meant to show you, it's specifically designed to show you more of what you want to see, right? And so these algorithms that they've built in, if you are already, looking at this stuff, it is going to show you more and more and more. And it's really hard for them to change that because that's kind of the point of the whole platform. So it is, like you said, it's whack-a-mole, right? You have these big companies, and they're always kind of playing catch up, right? This is something you think they would have been really getting on top of a year ago when, you know, we're coming up on the, you know, the year anniversary in the U.S. at least of the virus. So the fact that they are only now saying we're really going to crack down, it's like, well, great, we appreciate that, but what have you been doing the last year? And again, this stuff is out there, you know, and it just takes a minute on YouTube for somebody, you know, as soon as a video is taken down to pop it up somewhere else. And it's really, really hard, but they also just need to devote more resources, more technology, and more, you know, actual just will to address this problem, because it's very serious. As we've seen, even world leaders are promoting this kind of misinformation and disinformation. So they really need to work harder, but again, it is a challenge.
David Rennie, on this question of disinformation, China has been putting out a lot of propaganda connected to the West's struggles to control all the disinformation. What have they been saying?
So China has a giant sort of propaganda ambition, which is to change the subject from the idea that the virus began in China, that it began in Wuhan, that it got a hold and maybe spread to the world and had time to spread to the whole world because China covered it up at the beginning. That is such a dangerous narrative now, with 2 million people dead worldwide, that China is throwing everything it can into any number of alternative theories. So they're pushing very, very hard. And unfortunately, we saw the World Health Organization team kind of bowing to some of those Chinese propaganda narratives. So sort of saying that they couldn't rule out that maybe the virus came into China on frozen food packaging, though outside China, there are very few reputable scientists who think that's true. They've said that maybe the virus was circulating in the second half of 2019 in all kinds of places, including America, India, Italy. You've had very senior officials, the Chinese ambassador to Washington, who's normally a pretty sensible, level-headed guy, under orders clearly from the machine, to say that now the WHO needs to go and investigate whether America was where the virus began. And I'm afraid that even if the rest of the world is not convinced by that, here in China, the idea that the virus began overseas and isn't China's fault is gaining traction. And China is doing itself no favors in terms of its ability to trash science and push discredited theories, because China wants to be a high-tech superpower that sells us, you know, the most sophisticated technologies of the 21st century. And I really think they're doing themselves tremendous long-term damage with this gigantic propaganda push.
Well, finally, guys, after the year we've all had, you can forgive some of us for daydreaming a little bit about a summer break, but not if you live in the UK. This week, its government found itself in a ton of trouble after it told folks they should not be making any plans to travel this summer. Here's the UK minister, Grant Shapps.
Well, look, it's too soon now, I'm afraid to say, either domestically or internationally, not least because right now we're saying you can't leave your home unless it's for one of 5 specific reasons, and one of them is not going on holiday.
Well, that went down very badly, as you might expect, David. The Brits take their vacation very seriously. A week in the sun goes a very long way. Did the government kind of just get caught saying the bad thing out loud here?
The bigger picture is that the British public elected Boris Johnson with a gigantic majority to do a completely different job from the one that he now finds himself doing. He was elected because he was this kind of super optimistic, don't let's listen to the moaning, hand-wringing experts. We can make Brexit a huge success. The experts don't know what they're talking about. We're going to be this plucky, buccaneering, swashbuckling, swaggering Britain. And then COVID arrived. And you have this super optimistic guy who doesn't do detail, who doesn't like experts, in charge of this absolutely terrifying public health crisis. And you see him wrestling with his instincts. So as recently as the 1st of February, Boris Johnson was saying he was optimistic that people could have summer holidays. And, you know, you say everyone wants their week in the sun. Frankly, if you lived in Britain, in Britain's climate, you would also want a bit of sunshine sometimes. But, you know, the lockdown is really, really strict. The British didn't take the lockdown seriously for a long time, but right now it is super strict. You're not allowed outside your home. Most people aren't allowed to work. The schools are closed. Even things like weddings at the moment, you can only get married in the UK if one of the two people getting married is terminally ill and is not going to recover, and then they can only have 6 guests. I mean, that's the kind of the Britain we're dealing with. Boris Johnson did not plan to be in charge of that kind of a crisis, and so he's really kind of trying to find his feet, and they're saying that maybe there'll be some more news towards the end of the month of February where they may have better news about holidays. But it's really, you know, Britain is in a very, very bad place right now.
Dave Lawler, if you could dream about where you might travel this summer, dare I ask, what would be the top of your list?
Well, I should say I am attempting to get married in the next few months, and neither my wife nor I are terminally ill, thankfully. So in the U.S.,
congratulations. Those rules are,
well, thank you. But yeah, it's slightly less strict here, but still quite a minefield to navigate. I mean, if I could go anywhere over this summer, it would be maybe as far away from my apartment as I could possibly get, because I've spent a long time here over the last year or so working from home. So I would just pick a spot on the map that was really far away and hop on a plane.
Jen, while we're in this mind space, what about you? Where would you go?
You know, look, I'm kind of in the same boat in terms of getting as far away as possible. My dream would be Bali, but at this point, I would be just happy to go to the grocery store without wearing a mask. But that's not in the cards right now.
We can all dream. We can all dream. I want to thank all of you, our wonderful guests this week, for joining us. Jennifer Williams is senior foreign editor at Vox. David Rennie, again, stayed up very late for us. Thank you. He is Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. And Dave Lawler is the world news editor for Axios. 1A's managing producer is Paige Osborne. Jake Cherry is our sound designer and engineer. And Barb Anguiano produces our podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Amna Nawaz from the PBS NewsHour, in for Jen White. Jen will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend to everyone out there. Thank you for listening, and please stay safe. This is 1A.